Well, hello and welcome to today's City Club of Boise virtual conversation, an interview with Arthur Mark Johnson. I'm Dr. Bill Russell, today's moderator. First, a little bit of business. As always, thank you for joining us. I want to welcome our radio listeners who will be joining us at a later date via Boise State Public Radio. Today's forum is available in large part because of our City Club partners and sponsors. I would like to take time to thank a few of those organizations that help us achieve our mission to ensure compelling conversations, engage citizens in a dynamic community. Our premier sponsor is Northwest Nazarene University and the NNU College of Business. Our annual sponsor is the University of Idaho. We also receive support from our forum series sponsors, AARP of Idaho, Bank of Idaho, Climatech Corporation, Echelon Group, Micron, Pacific Source Health Plans, Small Mine Development, and St. Luke's Health System. City Club of Boise also receives grant funding from the Idaho Humanities Council. We thank also our media partners, which include Boise State Public Radio, 670 KBOI, the Idaho Statesman, and Idaho Public Television, and our university partners, BSU and NNU. Finally, I'd like to thank the members of City Club of Boise, the individuals and organizations who understand the need to find common ground, listen, seek shared solutions, and learn with respect from each other. City Club of Boise members are foundational to our community. Thank you for your support. Mark Johnson, who is a founding member of City Club of Boise, has worked as a broadcast journalist, primarily with the Idaho Public Television, and as a communication and crisis management consultant. He served as press secretary and chief of staff to Idaho's longest serving governor, Cecil Andrus. His latest book, which we'll talk about today, Tuesday Night Massacre, Four Senate Elections and the Radicalization of the Republican Party, explores how independent expenditure campaigns help upend American politics after 1980. We'll be talking about that today. His second book, The Political Hellraiser, a biography of Montana New Deal era Senator Burton Wheeler, was named a Spur Award finalist in 2020 by the Western Writers of America. Johnson's writing on politics and history have been published in the New York Times, the California Journal of Politics and Policy, the Blue Review at Boise State, and Montana, the Magazine of Western History. He is a regular columnist for the Lewiston Tribune, and he writes regularly on the blog, Many Things Considered. Those of you who have followed Idaho politics for many years know his name well, and I'm really looking forward to a chance to talk with him about this new book, Tuesday Night Massacre. Welcome, Mark. We're glad to have you with us.
Bill, it's a real pleasure to be with you and be back with City Club once again. Thank you so much.
Well, I'd like you to start by just telling us about the book. What is it? And we'll talk about specifics, but I'd just like to hear you tell us what it is and give us some prediction of what you're going to be talking about.
Thank you. Sure. We probably should start with the title. Tuesday Night Massacre refers to November 4th, 1980, those of us who are old enough to remember it will remember that was the Reagan landslide, Ronald Reagan defeating Jimmy Carter in the presidential campaign in a landslide, really one of the most significant elections of the 20th century, I think, without a doubt. But my book focuses on something else that happened on that Tuesday, and that was the U.S. Senate flipping to Republican control for the first time in a quarter century since the Eisenhower administration. 12 Democratic seats flipped to Republican control on that Tuesday night, hence the massacre. And I believe 1980, with the perfect hindsight of 40 years, you can see was a real hinge point in American politics where a number of things came together sort of simultaneously to redefine the way we think about particularly U.S. Senate campaigns now. And I can go into those in some detail, Bill, but the basic thrust is that this was a really important election that upended the way we think about United States Senate campaigns ever since, put a new kind of money into these campaigns and a sharper edged message driven by what I refer to as the new right, a collection of activist groups on the far right of the American political spectrum, and a group called NCPAC, the National Conservative Political Action Committee, which is kind of the centerpiece in the book, was the tip of the spear, if you will, in this new right coalition in 1980.
Well, you know, it's noteworthy that that this is a night that happened over 40 years ago, and yet you still see power from that night and the ripples of the waves from what happened in that night. Tell us how you went about this project. What inspired you to take this on?
Well, I was a pretty green behind the ears, wet behind the ears reporter working for public television in 1980. So I remember firsthand the campaign between the incumbent Frank Church and then Congressman Steve Sims, who ultimately defeated Church in that 1980 election. I covered it. I had the pleasure as a host of Idaho Reports back in those days to moderate both of the debates between the candidates. So I'd like to think that I knew something at the time was happening that was really kind of significant in American politics. But
and that's one of the four elections that you talk about in the book, and we'll spend right. some time on that election.
Yeah, but your question was what motivated it. It was, at one level, it was a kind of a personal motivation to dig back into that story and see if what I believe now after 40 years is true, that it really was a significant turning point, a hinge point, if you will, in American politics.
So tell us how you went about research and writing this story.
Well, I want to say, give a shout out to the archives at Boise State University. Cheryl Ostriger, the head of special collections at Boise State, has done a marvelous job of archiving and making available to researchers, Senator Church's papers, my old boss, Governor Andrus's papers are there, Lynn Jordan's papers are there. So you have the benefit, again, this much time has elapsed since those events, to be able to go to archives and find the kind of material that if you had as a reporter in real time, you would really have loved to have. Polling memos, information about the campaign strategy. And that material is available in archives across the country. George McGovern, who I write about, the South Dakota senator, his archives are at Princeton University, very complete archives with lots and lots of material related to this period. Same with John Culver in Iowa. His papers are at the University of Iowa. So I tried to use primary sources, if you will, where I could. I relied a lot on contemporary accounts of journalists. I did a number of interviews with people who were involved in the campaigns in the various states. And then, of course, I relied on secondary sources, books that have been written about what's happened to American politics in the intervening 40 years.
And was everybody cooperative with the effort?
For the most part, yeah. Most people were quite cooperative. One strange thing that I still am trying to understand, Dan Quayle is one of the central characters in the book, United States Senator elected in 1980 in this Tuesday night massacre, went on to become Vice President of the United States under George H.W. Bush. Of all of the senators who are no longer in office, he's the only one whose papers are not available to researchers. They have been collected, they're archived, but they are not available to researchers. So I reached out trying to get an opportunity to see some of the material related to the 1980 campaign and his papers, but they're not available. But for the most part, as you ask, most people were very helpful. Yeah.
You know, I remember Quayle as the guy who couldn't spell the word potato in public.
The guy who got into a bit of a controversy over his criticism of the television show Murphy Brown. he was kind of a walking, talking gaffe machine. Very, very handsome guy, very telegenic, a great retail campaigner when he took on Birch Bayh in Indiana in 1980, very senior Democratic senator, and beat him with the help of this new right coalition and NCPAC.
You mentioned NCPAC, and you said a minute ago that it was central to the story that that you've told here. I would describe NCPAC probably as the antagonist of this story. They certainly are centered everything that you talk about, and some of the players in NCPAC, some of whom still have been in the news recently. So why don't you tell us a little bit about NCPAC and sure. what they were and how they came to be?
Well, NCPAC was a political action committee formed by three young Republican conservative activists in 1975, all of these guys have been veterans of the young college Republicans, young Republican movement, had been active in campaigns at a pretty low level. They all came together in 1975 with encouragement from Jesse Helms, the powerful Republican senator from North Carolina, who encouraged them. One of his aides, a guy named Charlie Black, was one of the original founders, along with Terry Dolan, who became the executive director of the group, and a guy whose name is still in the headlines, Roger Stone, the self-described dirty trickster, confidant, most recently of Donald Trump, had his sentence commuted for obstructing the congressional investigation of the Russian interference in the 2016 election. Those three guys came together with Helms's encouragement to form this political action committee, really, I think, to try to accomplish two things. One, they wanted to take over the messaging, if you will, of the Republican Party in that period, and they wanted to create a more ideological party, get rid of the moderates out of the party. That was a constant message from Terry Dolan. A party that has moderates can't possibly be a party that conservatives can be comfortable with. And so for the most part, they eventually succeeded in ridding the party of moderates. And that's essentially where the Republican Party is today. But they came together in 1975 to try to, you know, play at the highest levels of American politics. And a court case in 1976, the famous Buckley versus Vallejo case, a foundational case in all of the cases that followed that sorted out American law as it relates to campaign finance, really empowered a political action committee like NCPAC to raise and spend unlimited amounts of money. They didn't have any constraints about how much money they could raise from individuals or big checks, and they could spend it as they saw fit with, frankly, very little accountability. And by 1980, they had perfected the model of using these political action committee efforts to target the four Democrats that I write about in the book, Frank Church, George McGovern, Birch Bayh, and John Culver. And it was a remarkably successful effort, built on, you know, sophisticated public opinion polling, a desire to kind of rile up conservative voters, to make them angry, to have them act on a sense of grievance that things were going off the rails in the country. And it was very successful.
Mark, you talk in the book about the difference between campaigning for a candidate and campaigning against other candidates. Can you talk a little bit about that and what that led to with NCPAC?
Yes, Bill, NCPAC took the attitude very much that they were going to be against the incumbents. They could have run campaigns demonstrably supporting the conservative challengers, Steve Sims in Idaho, for example, but generally they ran really negative campaigns against the incumbents. And as Dolan sort of infamously said fairly early on in this effort, he said by 1980, and they started very early to redefine Frank Church's record, but he said by 1980, people in Idaho will be voting against Frank Church and they won't even remember why. Direct quote. He was, you know, very adamant that it was about redefining the character of these incumbent Democrats, making them susceptible to negative attacks and dragging down their approval rating with the public, which ultimately got these campaigns in each of these states into a position where the Republicans could really challenge successfully.
So let's talk for a minute about the Idaho angle, Church and Sims. Frank Church has served four terms and was running for his fifth. What jumps out at you about that story as a part of the NCPAC story and the story of the four candidates?
Well, Church was a big target for the new right for a couple of reasons. One, because of his longevity. He was the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee in this period. He had led the Senate investigation into the intelligence agencies in the mid-70s. I argue in the book, and I think many people agree, that investigation, the so-called Church Committee investigation, primarily directed at the Central Intelligence Agency, was arguably the single most important congressional investigation in the history of the country in terms of exposing to the American people what its government was doing in its in their name. So he is a big target for the new right, who saw him as being pretty effective, somebody that could move public opinion. He had presidential ambitions and did run for president in 1976. So he's a big target. And the challenge that Nick Pack faced, and frankly, any Republican that was going to challenge Church faced, was how do we get this guy's approval ratings drugged down to the level where we can make an effective campaign against him? And that's where the negative attacks came in, starting very, very early in 1979, with television, direct mail, newspaper ads, news releases, every kind of communications vehicle you can imagine that was available at that time, to start to redefine this guy as somebody who was a danger to national security, somebody who was out of touch with his own state, too liberal for Idaho. And by the time the campaign got really going in the summer of 1980, his approval ratings, which had been quite high earlier in 1979, they were underwater, and he was clearly very vulnerable at that point.
Well, and you think about Frank Church as a four-term senator, 24 years in a state that has been a conservative state. He was a fascinating story in his own. So I understand why they looked at him.
Well, and the other thing, Bill, that is important about this story, I think, and still resonates in our politics today, is the fact that after 1980, every Senate race in the country became a national contest. Money from all over the country flows into these races now. You just have to look at what happened in Georgia in the runoffs earlier this year, where $430 million in outside money was spent in those two campaigns in a very short period of time. So all of these races now have come down to not necessarily, hardly at all does it matter which candidate might actually be best able to represent the interests of the state of Georgia or the state of whatever, pick your state. It becomes a question over which party is going to control the United States Senate. So Frank Church, throughout his political career, and I think one of the reasons he did survive for four terms, was because he paid very close attention to Idaho issues. He was well-versed in Idaho issues. You told me a story when we were talking earlier, Bill, about his knowledge about what was going on with the Boise Redevelopment Agency in the late 70s. I remember the American Falls Dam in eastern Idaho was in some need of major repair. That's the kind of issue that Church was good at championing. He was a proponent of the National Laboratory, INEL, as it was known in those days. So he's very much in touch with local issues. So to really get after him, they had to nationalize the election, make it about big things like the fact that he was alleged to have been the ringleader to give away the Panama Canal, that he was soft on national defense, even though he was a decorated World War II veteran. So it was a real effort to nationalize these contests and make every election, and subsequently, I would argue, every Senate election has been largely a contest about which party's going to control the Senate.
Well, and I remember Frank Church as somebody who was well supported by elderly, his support for senior citizens, and
for a long time chaired a select committee in the Senate on senior issues. Yeah,
yeah, and that's a shift when you go from that kind of issue being important to the Panama Canal. Those are sea changes, and I can understand why there was a desire to go after him.
My old boss, Cease Andrus, used to joke in that period that he couldn't under. He said, "I can't understand why the Panama Canal is such a big issue in Idaho." Now, what does that run from Franklin to Montpelier? He was trying to make an analogy about irrigation farming in south eastern Idaho. As you know, that's an issue that really is important. Not so much the Panama Canal. But I think there's a lot of scholarship that's been done that said that really was a motivating issue for a lot of people. They were really angry and made to be angry about the fact that the United States had given away the Panama Canal, had returned sovereignty to Panama.
I want to remind our listeners that the Zoom Q&A function is in effect, and you can type in a question there, and that will make its way to Mark and I, or you can send a question to morgan@cityclubofboise.org, and we'll get those questions. Mark, talk to me a little bit about the Idaho Statesman's role in the 1980 Idaho election. You and I talked about that when we talked before, and I thought there were some interesting aspects to that.
Well, the Statesman was very involved, very aggressive, I would say, in covering this campaign. Lots of Idaho newspapers did a really admirable job as I've looked back on it. And I went through the archives pretty carefully for the Times News and the Lewiston Tribune and the Statesman, particularly Post Register. They all did a good job of covering the race, but the Statesman was particularly involved in trying to figure out the larger implications of this campaign between Church and Sims. Rod Grammer was the political reporter at the Statesman at that time, who the Statesman, you know, sent Rod back to Arlington, Virginia to interview this guy, Terry Dolan. As far as I could tell in my research, one of the few times that one of these newspapers actually centered in the state where Nick Pack was playing so heavily had actually invested the time and effort and money to send a reporter to try to talk to these people and figure out what their motivations were. And increasingly during the campaign, the Statesman's editorial coverage, at least, became more critical of the Nick Pack New Right effort, labeling a lot of what they were doing a big lie, repeating over and over distortions of Senator Church's record, and getting away with it, frankly, not being held to account for it. And of course, in the same kind of playbook that a certain recent occupant of the White House has used quite successfully, demonizing the press became a part of the tactics of the New Right. And Dolan, at one point, for example, said, well, you know, we can't possibly get fair coverage from the Statesman because they're totally in bed with Frank Church. Well, that's, you know, it's not true. It was not true. But nonetheless, there were some bumper stickers started to appear around southwestern Idaho saying, I'm voting for Steve Sims, the Statesman made me do it. So it was kind of an early glimpse, I guess, of how the media can be pulled in and has been completely pulled in now to, you know, taking sides in these elections or being accused of taking sides in these elections. If I could just say a word more about Terry Dolan and why I think he's kind of a model for what we're seeing in some aspects in the Republican Party today. Dolan is a really interesting character. He's only in his 20s in this period. But as I mentioned, he's really an attractive character, nice looking young guy, very well spoken, and had a real knack for turning a phrase, a great soundbite, as we used to say in TV. He could give the one-line answer to a pithy one-line answer to a question. He said, for example, at one point, we could, you know, with the tactics that we're using, we could elect Mickey Mouse to the United States Senate. Direct quote. Another time he said, you know, groups like ours could be very dangerous. You could have 10 of these political action committees get together and, you know, we could lie about somebody and never be held to account for it. And the people will be voting against Frank Church in Idaho and they won't even remember why. So he's very quotable. Press sort of gravitated to him as a result of that because he's good copy. He would later become very critical even of the Reagan administration. He thought Ronald Reagan had brought way too many moderates into his administration. When James Baker became White House Chief of Staff, Dolan was very upset about that, Baker being way too much of a squishy moderate for his take. He even criticized at one point Maureen Reagan, President Reagan's daughter, saying that she was too moderate, she ought to be muzzled for the sake of the party. So he's a really aggressive young guy who's, in a lot of respects, his whole shtick was to be able to get into the press, to stir it up, to be outrageous, to be just a little bit over the line all the time. He kind of reminds me of this young Florida Congressman, Matt Gaetz, who seems to be in the news all the time, only because he seems to be good at being in the news all the time. And that's kind of what Terry Dolan was all about.
He did eventually fade from the scene.
He did eventually fade. Nick Pack tried to mount a sort of a repeat in the 1982 cycle of the same kind of tactics, targeting another wave of Democratic incumbents, and the whole effort kind of fell flat. I think those that were being challenged in 1982 were better prepared for it. They understood what was coming better. And by 1984 or so, 1985, Dolan is and NCPAC is really in decline. They run into financial trouble. They're behind in paying their bills. And he eventually steps aside from the leadership of the organization and died shortly after that at a very young age.
Okay, let's go to some of the questions from the audience, and there are some interesting ones. I want to start with this one. In what ways were the 1980 defeats of the four Democratic senators or the presaged by the defeat or forced retirement of other liberal Democratic senators in the West, Lee Metcalf in Montana, Frank Moss in Utah, Gail McGee in Wyoming, all of whom were gone several years before 1980? Was the liberal Democrat an endangered species in the West long before 1980?
That's a really great question. And I think a partial answer is yes, for sure. I think that, you know, Metcalf in Montana, who I probably know better than any of the others, goes on to be replaced by a Democrat, not the case in Wyoming with Gail McGee. So yeah, I think the kind of traditional Western Rocky Mountain liberal, if that's the right term, was becoming more and more of an endangered species, and that only accelerated after 1980. It's, you know, and I have to admit, 1980, beyond NCPAC's role in these campaigns, was a tough year to be a Democrat. I had an unpopular president in Jimmy Carter. The Iranian hostage crisis had been going on for months and months. Real concern about the economy, inflation, and gas prices soaring. So it was a tough time to be a Democrat generally, but it was a particularly tough time when you've got the new right, so to speak, the moral majority, the Phyllis Schlafly group, the Eagle Forum, coming after these guys on a whole host of sort of cultural, socially cultural issues, abortion, you know, gay rights, all of that sort of thing, all tied up and mixed up in these races. Kinds of issues that guys like, frankly, like Lee Metcalf and Gail McGee and Frank Church rarely, if ever, had to deal with before the 1970s.
And of course, of the four that you write about in the book, they're not all Westerners. They reach back, and to some degree, NCPAC was able to, if there was some deterioration of the Western liberal Democrat, Tony Dolan was able to take some of that back further east.
The common thread among the four states, Indiana, Iowa, South Dakota, and Idaho, is they are fundamentally have always been very conservative places, very, you know, sort of more Republican, certainly, than Democratic states, and pretty rural states, for the most part, not dominated by one necessarily big media market. So there's a common thread that ran through there, which I think NCPAC seized on very strategically because they realized their money would go a lot farther in these smaller, generally conservative rural states.
Mark, you haven't talked about where NCPAC got its funding. Where did the NCPAC money come from? Do we know?
Yes, we do know. At least we know most of the story. I mentioned Jesse Helms earlier as being instrumental, sort of the godfather of the founding of this organization. The other thing, the other two people that he brought to the table were his fundraiser, a guy named Richard Viguerie, who's still around, sometimes referred to as the funding father of the new right. Viguerie, as early as the Barry Goldwater campaign in 1964, really seized on the idea that he could use direct mail fundraising to both deliver a message to voters and, with that little envelope that was always stuck in with the message, get them to send back a check and another check and another check and another check. So the vast amount of their money was raised by Richard Viguerie's direct mail fundraising. Viguerie was helped in that messaging by the polling that was done, and public opinion polling was done by a guy by the name of Arthur Finkelstein, who was also Jesse Helms's pollster. And Finkelstein was a fascinating character. He died just a few years ago, had helped a lot of very conservative Republicans with campaigns, and had a particular knack in being able to tease out the emotion that was in an issue. I quote someone in the book as saying that he could look at a polling, the results of a poll, and see emotion. So he was very skillful at crafting these messages that were, you know, getting people riled up, playing on their animosity toward liberals, stoking their disdain for Eastern elites, kind of the same kind of rhetoric that we often associate now with many figures in the Republican Party.
Mark, you mentioned earlier the 400 plus million that that were spent in Georgia in what, a 2 month period?
Right.
Do we know how much Nick Pack invested in the 1980 election?
Yeah, by today's standards, it's sort of it's almost de minimis. They raised, you know, several million dollars in the 1980 cycle. Most of the money they spent in the in that cycle was on Reagan's presidential campaign. They targeted voters in southern states where they worried that maybe Jimmy Carter, a southerner, would have an advantage against Ronald Reagan. So they spent quite a bit of money in support of Reagan's campaign. The amount of money that they spent in these individual state races was really, by today's standards, pretty minimal. I think what was important about it was that it allowed them to drive the message. So they would spend a little bit on television, then they would be able to, you know, direct mail fundraise off of that, and the direct mail piece would reinforce the message that people had seen on television or heard on the radio. So it was kind of a perfectly synchronized mass marketing campaign, if you will, that really didn't cost them a tremendous amount of money. And the money, again, by today's standards, seems almost insignificant. You know, probably, $7 or $8 million raised in total in that 1980 cycle, compared to, as I mentioned, hundreds of millions of dollars being raised in these Senate races today. But before 1980, this had really never happened. This was a brand new phenomenon on a national basis.
Big number then. I have trouble imagining how you spend $400 million in one state in 60 days.
There's going to be some interesting research done on that. At some point, there's got to be a point of diminishing returns. I saw one statistic that one of the television stations in Atlanta, for example, in that period between the November election, general election, and the January runoff, something like $90 million had been spent on one television station in the Atlanta market. So at some point, you think there's a point of diminishing returns where that many television commercials in such a compressed period of time really maybe even turns people off at some level.
You know, you talked about the Statesman. I'm curious, did Nick Pack buy ads in the Statesman during this time?
They did, and they bought ads actually attacking the Statesman in the Statesman.
In the Statesman.
Yes.
Oh, that's fun. Another question from the audience. Racial inequality is centered in conservative and liberal politics today. How did race play a part in the Tuesday night massacre?
Indirectly, I think it had an impact in the sense that, you know, none of these states that I'm writing about have huge minority populations. But there was an ability, I think, because of the way the messaging was arranged and the anger at Democrats was stoked, that you see a lot of the same techniques that we're seeing now in terms of sort of scapegoating people. And so that was clearly part of the messaging. It was certainly not an overt, racially tinged message in any of these states, because that probably wouldn't have been very effective. But some of the same techniques in terms of the kind of language that was employed and the kind of resentment that was fostered clearly was part of it. And Jesse Helms, God rest his soul, had made his career around stoking racial animosity in his own races for the Senate in North Carolina going way, way back.
Do you think there was any of that at play in Idaho?
I don't see much evidence of it. I do think there was an effort to sort of strike at what maybe we call class division, and as opposed to racial divisions, rural versus urban divisions. Again, some of the fault lines that we see in politics today, but not so much directed at race as a motivating factor for people to vote against someone.
So in Idaho, there's always been a political line between the North and the South. I remember stories about church waiting until late at night for the North to come in. How did Nick Pack address the northern part of Idaho, or did they?
You know, I think my analysis and some other scholarship that's been done on the race draws the conclusion that Steve Sims basically held his own in North Idaho against Church, a traditionally Democratic area that had, you know, almost always in the past been a Democratic stronghold. Places like Shoshone County, Nez Perce County, Clearwater County, very strong Democratic areas traditionally. Sims did pretty well there because in part it was his congressional district, but where he really broke through was in Eastern Idaho. Frank Church had always been very popular in the second congressional district, the area from, you know, Boise east to the Wyoming border, Idaho Falls, Pocatello, et cetera. But in 1980, Sims really broke through there. And I think my analysis is that one of the reasons he broke through was because these issues, like the Panama Canal treaties, which, by the way, had been decided by the Senate on a bipartisan basis in 1978, but was still being stoked by these new right groups in the 1980 campaign, that issue, really hurt Frank Church in Eastern Idaho and helped Steve Sims. And it's no accident that late in the campaign, candidate Ronald Reagan flies into Idaho Falls for a big rally for Congressman Sims, and undoubtedly that was helpful. There's one other aspect of it that is intriguing and probably impossible to really ascertain the ultimate effect. But President Carter, much to the chagrin of many Democrats in the West and on the West Coast in particular, conceded his reelection defeat to President-elect Reagan very early on election night. And before the polls had closed in many places in the Pacific time zone, including North Idaho. So there's some anecdotal evidence that people were, you know, driving to the polling places, heard on the radio that Carter had conceded the election and turned around and went home without voting. Now, my personal view is that that was not a decisive factor in the race. It was perhaps a contributing factor. And Church only lost, after all, by 4,400 votes, which was the closest of any of these four elections. So he came remarkably close to surviving the Reagan landslide and a pretty toxic political environment for Democrats.
Another question from the audience. Politics of grievance was a major thrust of Nick Pack. Had politics of grievance been used extensively before?
Well, certainly it had. It's always been an aspect of American politics. I think you can date the grievance politics in the Republican Party probably to Joe McCarthy in the 1950s. The sense that, liberal Democrats were squishy on communism and we had to be very concerned about their loyalty to the country. And there was a grievance element clearly driving McCarthy. I read with interest a piece in the New York Times just yesterday by Jonathan Martin, a reporter that I have a lot of regard for, national political correspondent for the Times. He's writing about the CPAC convention last weekend where former President Trump and some of the most conservative members of the Republican Party showed up to give speeches to this activist group. And Jonathan Martin noted, and I think he's correctly noted, that grievance has long been a theme in Republican politics, certainly going back to the Goldwater era, and I would even argue further back to Joe McCarthy. What is different about 1980 is that it's weaponized on a national basis, highly coordinated, and well-financed. And that's the difference.
I'd like to remind our radio listeners that you are listening to a City Club of Boise virtual conversation featuring a discussion with author Mark Johnson. I'd also like to remind our listeners that you can go to the Q&A function at the bottom of your screen. It's the two little dialogue clouds. Click that and you can type in a question and it will make its way here for us to put to Mark. Mark, we talked about the Idaho race. There are three other races here. What of the other three do you find most interesting?
Well, I find them all interesting, but I think perhaps the most interesting was the race in Iowa between John Culver, a Democratic incumbent, and a guy who's still around, Chuck Grassley, now the longest serving member of the United States Senate, who is being coy about whether he's going to run, I think, for an eighth term. So Grassley was elected to the Senate the first time in 1980 in this same Tuesday night massacre. He runs against a guy by the name of John Culver, who was the junior member of this foursome that I write about. Culver had served in the House of Representatives from Iowa, had been a staffer to Ted Kennedy, who was a good friend of his when they went to Harvard at the same time, played football at Harvard, was a good enough football player that there was speculation that he could have had an NFL career if he would have wanted to forsake politics and gone to the football field full time. Culver ran in 1980 as an unabashed liberal. He told his staff, you know, if I have to change my stripes, if I have to do something that is contrary to my own belief system in order to try to get reelected, the job is just not worth it to me to do that. Culver came to the Senate determined to be a player right from the get-go. He secured a position on the Armed Services Committee, and within a very short period of time was generally regarded in the Senate as one of the leading experts on national security policy. Had written extensively about it, studied it carefully, and it was turned against him. He had opposed a couple of weapon systems, including the B-1 bomber at that point, and said that he thought it was an unnecessary expenditure that wasn't going to improve national security. That was portrayed as him being soft on national defense. Culver was very insightful as well as to what these new right attacks were going to mean for the future of the Senate and for individual senators. He said at one point in a speech during the campaign that he was really concerned that when you make a discreet vote in the Senate that can then be weaponized against you, he said it's going to cause people to really be careful about how they, ultra careful about how they conduct themselves. And he said it'll cause people to lack courage, to be unwilling to take a difficult position and then go home and explain it to their constituents. And I think that's one of the lasting messages from these 1980 campaigns. What's happened to the Senate in the intervening 40 years? Steve Sims, I quote Steve Sims in the book, is saying, some of the votes that were made in the Senate leading up to 1980 were strategically designed to box these guys in so that they could have a campaign issue to run against them. And that contributed to sort of the erosion of bipartisanship in the Senate, not sort of the erosion, the almost complete erosion of bipartisanship in the Senate. And both parties have some guilt for sure in this regard. But when every Senate election becomes sort of a partisan grudge match between people who then have to dust themselves off after the campaign and try to find a way to compromise, work together, that becomes a very, very difficult thing to do. And it has become an almost impossible thing to do, it seems, in the Senate of 2021.
So here's another question from the audience. This may be another book for you, Mark, but it seems a similar situation to 1980 occurred in 1994 with the congressional election that made Newt Gingrich Speaker of the House. He brought a real edge to House politics. What are your thoughts about the similarities between 80 and 94?
I agree very much with the premise of the question. And Julian Zelenzer, a great scholar at Princeton, has written a book about that, Burning Down the House, how Newt Gingrich took over the Congress, the House of Representatives, in that 1994 campaign and really changed the nature of the Republican Party in the House of Representatives. I argue in my book that Gingrich is a natural, is a part of the natural sequence from Goldwater to Nick Pack to Gingrich to ultimately Donald Trump. And in fact, Nick Pack had been a supporter of Gingrich's in his early campaigns for the House from Georgia. He had gone to campaign schools put on by Nick Pack. He received financial support from Nick Pack. And I believe after he lost his first election to the House in 1976, he came away thinking he had to sharpen his message. He had to be more ideological. He had to be more of the Newt Gingrich that we've come to recognize as being sort of this in-your-face, highly ideological politician, which he had not been prior to 1978. So I think, yeah, he's a logical extension of what we're seeing, what we did see in 1980. And he, you know, very much subscribed to the Terry Dolan notion of ridding the party of moderates, making the party much more ideological, and essentially making, you know, legislating in Congress war without the shooting, as somebody said. Every issue was going to be decided on the basis of who had the strongest partisan argument. And a lot of people, a lot of scholars, a lot of observers of American politics give Gingrich a lot of credit for responsibility, if you will, for what's become of our politics. I think he inherited a lot of his attitudes and his tactics from some of these earlier generation new right activists.
Mark, the race that beyond, of course, Church and Sims, because most of us know a lot about that. The race that I found most interesting was Dan Quayle and Birch Bayh, in part because Bayh had been such a powerful person, and in part because of Quayle's history after that. But the story in the book that this is probably not all that political, but the story that fascinated me in the book was the story about the airplane crash. Do you want to talk about that for a minute?
Right. Well, Birch Bayh, you know, I knew a little bit about Birch Bayh before I started researching this book, and I came away really impressed with the enormity of his political career. Certainly one of the major figures in the United States Senate in the 20th century. It's been said correctly that he wrote more of the Constitution than anyone not a member of the founding generation. He was the author of two amendments to the Constitution, author of Title IX, that has meant so much to women in higher education, and particularly women in athletics in higher education. Very, very serious legislator. And I argue in the book that he actually, Dan Quayle was probably the least formidable candidate he ever faced. But Quayle was a opportunistic in the sense that he was able to capitalize on the timing of 1980 in order to beat Bayh. Bayh had been, was very close to Ted Kennedy in the Senate. Frankly, all of these guys were friendly with Ted Kennedy, probably Bayh and Culver more than McGovern and Church, but nonetheless, they were all friendly with Ted Kennedy. The very night that the Senate passed the Civil Rights Act in 1964, Kennedy and Bayh get on an airplane in Washington, D.C., to fly to a Democratic convention meeting in Massachusetts. Bayh is going to be the keynote speaker for this convention that is going to endorse Kennedy's reelection campaign. So they're flying to Massachusetts. Weather is bad. Plane crashes on final approach into an airport in Massachusetts. The pilot is killed on impact. Kennedy is knocked unconscious. Bayh and his wife are on board the plane, and somehow they're able to get out. His back is hurt. His legs are banged up. And he realizes, as he's, you know, kind of coming to his senses around this smoldering wreckage in a farmer's field, that Kennedy is still inside the plane. And if you remember Ted Kennedy, he's a big hulking guy, 6'2", probably 240 pounds. And somehow Bai was able to pull him out of that airplane through one of the windows of the plane, all the while smelling gasoline, aviation fuel, worried that the plane might explode. Kennedy suffered for the rest of his life the back injury that he sustained in that accident, in that crash. But he always credited Birch Bai with saving his life. He said, "I think I might well have died right there had Birch not pulled me out of that airplane." Quite a story.
Yeah, it is quite a story. The one of the things that interests me about these is that that of those Republicans that were able to win in that year, several of them had careers afterwards that were explosive to begin with and then just kind of faded. So Dan Quayle was gone for the gone from the scene before he was 50.
Right.
Steve Sims wasn't around very much longer. Of course, Steve had an issue with his wife and the divorce, but there were some of these people didn't last as long as Bai or as Grassley has.
Yeah, Grassley's the ultimate survivor of this group, obviously. Jim Abner, who defeated George McGovern in South Dakota, was a one-term member of the Senate. Not to be unkind to his memory, but I'd be hard-pressed to find a single piece of legislation that you could say, you know, Jim Abner really was responsible for this. I kind of characterized the guys that they were defeating as the traditionalists. Guys who went to the Senate for the most part during a period when the Senate was really a productive place, even during the turmoil of the 1960s. We see the Voting Rights Act, Civil Rights Act passed, Medicare is created, many of the Great Society programs are brought into place. The war in Vietnam is debated incessantly in the Senate, and ultimately you have to argue that this pushback that first Lyndon Johnson and then later Richard Nixon suffered over Vietnam came largely from the way the Senate responded to that piece of American history. So these guys went to the Senate with an agenda to accomplish things. The radicals, frankly, who replaced them were much more interested in, as somebody once said about the Idaho legislature, putting a rock on the no button. They wanted to be against things. They went to stop things from happening. And for the most part, when you're in a legislative body and your idea is to prevent things from happening, you don't have too much in the way of legislation to show for having been there for a period of time. So that's a real contrast between the guys who lost on the Tuesday Night Massacre and the guys who won, traditionalists versus radicals in many respects.
Another question from the audience. Did the four Democrats coordinate their strategies against Nick Back as their common foe, or did they merely focus on the individual Republican candidates who opposed them?
Well, the strategy of the incumbents was really kind of all over the map. They probably would have been well advised to try to coordinate more than they did. There was some effort, I think, to share information about what was going on in various states, but no coordinated strategy by any means. And that was part of the nefarious benefit of these negative campaigns being run by a third party. As Dolan said about the Church Sims race, he said, "We can do all the negative stuff and Steve Sims won't have to say a thing. He can run on, you know, the issues that he wants to run on." And so there was very little coordination among these campaigns on the Democratic side, and frankly, nothing that they tried worked very effectively. Church tried to take them on directly, and it served to almost amplify the attacks that were being made on him. Same with Culver in Iowa. Called him out by name, said these guys are inserting something into American politics that is very dangerous. But again, if your opponent says something, the guy that's on the ballot with you says something, you can, generally speaking, have more effect in responding to that than when you're responding to a nameless, largely faceless organization based in a high-rise office building in Alexandria, Virginia, which is NCPAC's headquarters.
Mark, I want to come forward now to today. And ask you about about what some on the Republican side would claim is the ultimate liberalization of the Democratic Party, with assertions that the Democrats are moving further left and becoming too liberal again. Do you think that's true? And do you think that that's related to what happened here? How did today's politics line up? I mean, you've talked about Trump and some of Trump's strategies, but what about on the Democratic side? Is the Democratic heritage here something that's noteworthy?
I think it is, for sure. And I think one of the consequences of the radicalization of the Republican Party over the last 40 years, if you buy my characterization of that, is that it has forced moderates out of both parties. There are fewer and fewer people that you would think of as really moderates in either party in the Senate, particularly. Maybe a Joe Manchin on the Democratic side. Kristen Sinema, the relatively new senator from Arizona, seems like she's trying to chart a moderate course, work across the aisle. On the Republican side, it's basically down to Lisa Murkowski, maybe once in a while Susan Collins, maybe Mitt Romney once in a while on the Republican side. I would think of a Mitt Romney as being a really, really conservative guy, but for he passes for something close to a moderate in the Republican Party these days. So the moderates have largely been purged from both political parties. But I think it's a mistake to say this is a symmetrical problem. Republicans are equally as guilty as Democrats. I don't think it's a symmetrical problem. I think Republican radicalization has been vastly more pronounced than any Democratic radicalization. And I just mentioned one key point about that. You hear a lot of language being tossed around about Democrats being a socialist party, or this particular cabinet appointee is a neo-socialist, as someone was referred to recently by a member of the Senate. But the fact of the matter is, Democrats had a socialist run in the last two presidential candidates, a self-described socialist run in the last two presidential nominating campaigns, and he lost both times. So the Democratic Party purposely chose somebody closer to the mainstream in Joe Biden than the fringes of party. So it's not a symmetrical issue. There's certainly blame on both sides of the political spectrum for the polarization that we're seeing in politics. But I think any fair reading of it says you have to place more of the responsibility on the way the GOP has emerged over the last 40 years.
Mark, we're coming to the end of our time, and I want everybody that's here with us to join me in thanking Mark for participating in today's discussion. Mark, I wouldn't be doing you good service if I didn't give you a chance to tell us all where and how we can get a hold of your book.
Thank you so much, Bill. And I want to thank the City Club again. This is like old homework, as I said. I have fond memories of being in on the ground floor of launching this organization with no real expectation back in those days that it would become as important and enduring a feature of civic and cultural life in Idaho as it's become. So congratulations to all who've carried that on. And Karin Sander, I know, is doing a great job as the president, and Morgan is terrific in organizing these forums. And all of you who spend so much time on this, I congratulate you. Rediscovered Books has Tuesday Night Massacre available right now. I'll be doing an event later in March with them and look forward to that. And of course, you can get it directly from the publisher, University of Oklahoma Press, but support that good local independent bookstore. They do a great job.
And I did, just so everybody knows, I did get my copy of it on Kindle. It's finally up on Amazon now, so you can get it there. I agree that the local bookstore is a good place, but just know that if you can't get there, it is available on Kindle, on Amazon. Again, Mark, thank you. We really appreciate the time you've taken with us, and we appreciate your good work on this. This is a fascinating point of time in history. And as you say, it's still reverberating. So thank you for helping us to see what happened back then.
Real pleasure to be with you. And thanks, everybody, for tuning in today. It's been a lot of fun. Thanks, Bill.
Thanks, all.